not on how I could help them and add value to them. My thinking was selfish. It was also short-sighted. Having lived in a farming community early in my career, I should have known better. I should have thought about the sowing and reaping principle. Sowing always precedes reaping. As leaders, our question every day should not be, will I reap a harvest? Instead, it should be, have I sowed seeds today? I know. I'm changing my metaphor from music to farmer, but stay with me. Said another way, am I trying to add value or take value? Am I focused on receiving or giving? As a soloist, it's very easy to make everything about myself. How am I performing? Is the orchestra making me sound good? Is my technique as good as I want it to be? Is my audience appreciating me and my performance? Is this moment helping my career? You see, good leaders shift from being self-focused to other-focused. They give more than they take. They focus on sowing, not reaping. As leaders, we need to maintain a seed-sowing mindset. What does that mean? It means that we should focus on adding value daily. Add as much value as possible, as often as possible. Never wait to add value. Give without keeping score so our motives stay pure, and welcome any return as an unexpected blessing. I want to spend the remainder of this chapter on the idea of adding value to those we conduct. I want to drill down on each aspect of this mindset so that you can embrace and practice it as a leader. So, let's tackle each one in turn. Number one, focus on adding value daily. Every day I look at my calendar and I ask myself, where can I add value today? This question prepares me mentally to be ready to add value to others within the framework of my day. I review the scheduled meetings and activities to discover where I can be intentional about helping people. I also ask myself, what additional opportunities to help others will be given to me today? When I ask myself this question in the morning, I usually don't know what the answer will be. But by asking it, I create a positive anticipation which prepares me mentally and emotionally to seek out and identify moments when I will be able to sow positive seeds in the lives of others. My experience over the years has convinced me that we receive what we believe, and that applies to opportunities to add value to others. Because I expect to have many opportunities, I am able to act on them. This is part of a positive cycle, a cycle of action that makes the world a better place. This cycle looks like this. Belief encourages anticipation. Anticipation creates intention. Intention helps us prioritize focus, and focus helps us to see the opportunity. Only when we see the opportunity are we able to take action on it. And when we do it, it inflames our passion to do more good, and that in turn fuels our belief. And that cycle begins all over again. This is a circle you definitely want to keep unbroken. Number two, add as much value as possible as often as possible. It's clear that there is a direct relationship between the seeds we sow and the harvest that we reap. The amount of value we add to others determines the possible return. The fewer the seeds, the smaller the harvest. The more seeds, the greater the harvest. This seems obvious. So I have a question for you. Why do so many people sow few seeds? Why do people not give more generously to others? Why do people not help others more? Everyone would like to reap a great harvest. I would. Wouldn't you? How can you hope to have a big return with a small investment? The foundation and core of every realized dream comes from sowing positive seeds. As leaders, we must stop wishing and start working. Instead of looking for the secret sauce of success, we must start sowing seeds of success. My friend James Crocker, a successful entrepreneur, recently shared a story with me. He had agreed to be a sponsor for a charity event and had decided along with his wife that the money they gave as a sponsor would be their extent of their contribution. But when they attended the banquet that was part of the event, they heard the organization's vision and needs, and they decided to give more money to the cause. Later that night, after he got home, James wondered if he had given too much. As he processed this question, he thought about something that had occurred to him several months before. James and a few of his friends went out on a boat trip to fish for lobsters and had succeeded in gathering a massive catch of 125 lobsters. When he got home, he had a freezer full of lobsters, more than enough to last him for an entire year. The day after James got home, his friend Jeff dropped by the house, and James offered him a lobster. Jeff was delighted. This interaction prompted James to ask himself, "Who else do I know who might like to have a lobster?" James got so excited by the idea of giving friends lobsters that by the end of the week, he had given away 122 lobsters, leaving only 3 for himself. He had such a great time giving. He didn't even mind that his supply had dwindled from enough for a year to, well, enough for a meal. A few days later, James went into the garage and was assaulted by a terrible stench. He followed his nose to the freezer and opened it to find that the electricity had gone out, and his remaining 3 lobsters had spoiled. As he cleaned up the mess, he felt sorry for himself. But then he remembered all the lobsters he had given away, and it gave him great joy. If he hadn't shared his bounty with others, all of it would have been wasted. James applied his lobster lesson to his donation at the charity event, and he was so glad that he had given more. He discovered that you don't lose the seeds you sow. The only ones wasted are the ones you don't sow. He had embraced the truth of this paradoxical statement. What you keep, you lose, and what you lose, you keep. Number 3. Never wait to add value. Too many people wait to do good. It's as though they're waiting for permission or inspiration. But we should never delay sowing seeds that benefit others. Instead, we should follow this motto: be the first to give or add value to another person when you can. When you add value to others, especially when you do it early and unprompted, you inspire others with your example. I know. I've been inspired by the positive actions of others. For example, when my mentor Les Parrott shared with me that the reason he wrote books was to add value to people, I was inspired to start doing the same. Going back to my childhood when I watched my father walk slowly through the crowd to touch the lives of others, I could see how people positively responded to him, and I wanted to do the same. These examples inspired me to be more giving, to sow seeds into the lives of others. There's another good reason not to wait to help others. People remember those who added value to them, and they are especially grateful to those who added and helped them first. I know I am. Thousands of people have sowed positive seeds into my life, too many to count. However, I remember many of those who were the first to sow into my life in a particular way. My 4th grade teacher, Mr. Horton, was the first person to tell me that I was a leader. Glenn Leatherwood, my junior high Sunday school teacher, was the first to share with me that there was a calling on my life. My mother was the first person to unconditionally love me. Professor Don Brown was the first person who told me that I was gifted. And Pastor Paul Dorsey was the first to say that my future held great promise. Should I continue? I could name 100 people who were the first to sow positive seeds in my life in a particular area. I remember so many of them. Why? They were the first. We can remember hundreds of firsts in our lives, yet we have difficulty remembering even a handful of people who added value to us second in a given area. Being first sets givers apart. Don't hesitate to help another person by sowing a positive seed in his or her life. Add value as early and often as you can. Help others to play music better. You just might become the leader someone remembers for encouraging them to greatness. Number 4. give without keeping score, so motives stay pure. I know that I've already explained how we can't reap a harvest if we don't sow the seeds, and we can't get a return without first giving. But receiving should not be our motive for giving. We live in a tit-for-tat culture. People are willing to scratch our backs if we're willing to scratch theirs. As leaders who add value to others, we should never keep score. We should sow seeds because it's the right thing to do. That's the only way to be sure that our motives remain pure. My thinking has changed over the years in this area. In the beginning, I was motivated by the return I would receive. I was focused on the harvest. I already shared how Zig Ziglar's quote about helping others changed my focus. But over time, I realized that placing emphasis on the return was diminishing the joy of helping others. I was thinking about how much and how long I had to give, not how much I was helping. Besides, when you add value to others, there isn't a guaranteed return. At that time, my focus began to shift from return to recognition. I realized that even if I never saw a return, I could at least receive recognition for the effort that I was making. After all, abundant seed sowers are not common, and when they show up, they stand out, and I liked being recognized for giving. But again, I realized that my quest for recognition undermined my efforts to help others. I'm sorry to say that there were times I'd hesitate to give unless someone was watching to see it. Anonymous givers don't get the photo op. I know, it's unfortunate, but that's the way I thought. My attitude began shifting when I remembered the words of Jesus who said, "Whenever you did one of these things to someone overlooked or ignored, that was me. You did it to me." Because I'm a person of faith, those words convicted me, but they also assured me. God sees the value when we add others, and it's like we did it for Him. That finally brought me to the correct belief about helping others, that it is the right thing to do. It is always the right thing to do, anytime, any place, with anyone. And the right way to do it is any way that you can. Any day we are giving is a good day, and we should never keep score. Number 5. Welcome any return as an unexpected blessing. When my leadership mindset began focusing on adding value by sowing positive seeds in the lives of others, I became more creative about how I could do that. I started my career by speaking once a week to my tiny congregation. Soon I started creating resources and sharing them. In time, I added writing. I started teaching at conferences, and later I started hosting my own events. I trained leaders so that they could train people who followed them. Beginning in 2009, I expanded to include social media. I started companies that develop leaders in businesses and in corporations, and I started training coaches. All that time, my focus was on adding value. My goal was only to sow seeds. But I have to say, the return has been incredible. The influence I have been given and the value I've added is far greater than I ever imagined it could be. And it feels as though the harvest has multiplied way beyond the seeds that I've sown. That has been a great blessing. If you keep sowing seeds and you do it while focused on giving rather than receiving, I believe that you too will receive a harvest of unexpected blessings. These are my thoughts on adding value. And that's what leaders do who leadership from soloist to conductor. They focus on helping others to be their best. In the end, can you be a successful person as a soloist? The answer is undoubtedly yes. Can you be a successful leader? I would say maybe, but only in a very limited way. To reach your leadership potential, and more importantly, to help others reach their individual and team potential, you need to make the shift from soloist to conductor. If you're willing to make that shift and do the work of leading others well, then you might have the opportunity to live a life like the one described by author Matthew Kelly, who wrote, "In a land where there are no musicians, in a land where there are no storytellers, teachers, and poets, In a land where there are no men and women of vision and leadership, in a land where there are no legends, saints, and champions, in a land where there are no dreamers, the people will most certainly perish. But you and I, we are the music makers. We are the storytellers, teachers, and poets. We are the men and women of vision and leadership. We are the legends, the saints, and the champions. And we are the dreamers of the dreams. I would add that we are the conductors who help others make beautiful music together. Now for just a personal moment with you. As I have read to you chapter 2, Shifting from Soloist to Conductor, the thought that comes to my mind is, do you want to add or do you want to multiply? I suppose if adding is enough for you, then I suppose a soloist will be just fine for you, because soloists basically just touch the people that they can alone touch without the help of anyone else. But let's just suppose for a moment, your vision of yourself is just a little bit bigger, and you say, wow, I think I've been adding, but it sure would be wonderful to multiply and compound my life and my influence and my values. That would be a wonderful thing. If that's the case, then that shift from soloist to conductor is absolutely essential. And what I want you to know is that you can make it. You can do this. My mentor, John Wooden, taught me so much about being part of a team. And basically, he said, John, the greatest challenge of a coach is to take a star player, a great player, and mold him into a team player. Because the star obviously wants everybody to throw the ball to him and wants everybody to feed him the ball and make him look good in a basketball game. And so my friend and mentor, John Wooden, he devised this simple little plan that I think turned a lot of his players that were stars from soloists to conductors. Here's what he said. In the basketball game, when one of the players on the team throws you a pass, it's a good pass. It's one that gets to you quickly. It's in the right place. It sets you up for you to score a basket. He said, when you shoot the ball and you score the basket, on the way back down the basketball court, take your hand and point your finger at the person that threw the pass. Nod to them and basically visually say, thank you. You're the one who set me up. You're the one that gave me the pass. If you wouldn't have gotten that pass to me on time in the way that you delivered it to me, I wouldn't have been able to score. Give the other person credit. One of the players, when he began to initiate this on his team, said, well, coach, well, what happens if somebody throws me a good pass and I score and I'm going back down the court and I point to them and they're not looking? Coach Wooden looked at him and he said, let me tell you something. That player will always be looking. Yes, he will. Because he knows, and he wants to know, from the person who scored, that he also is part of the team. That he also helped make that bucket. That he also helped make a difference. In fact, John Wooden used to say, the man who scores a basket has 10 hands. You see, each team has 5 players. Each player has 2 hands. And basically, he said, every time there's a score, it's not because you've got a star. It's because you've got 10 hands passing, receiving, working, playing together. That's what makes a team great. I want you to be a conductor. Instead of waiting for people to point at you and say, ha ha, you're the man, you're the woman, you're the star, just turn that around. Start pointing to other people. Start believing in them, loving them, encouraging them, lifting them. Trust me, it's more fun to be a conductor than a soloist. And you start compounding and multiplying, and you leave that small world of addition. That's what I want for you. And that's why I wrote this chapter. Okay, let's go to the next one together. Chapter 3, Goals to Growth, The Personal Development Shift. Improving yourself is the first step in improving everything else. When I started my leadership career, I had 2 goals. I wanted to help the people in my congregation, and I hoped to someday, by the end of my career, grow a church to an attendance of 500 people. I had a pretty good sense of how to accomplish the first task, and I'd watched my father help people every day of his life, plus I had natural people skills. But I had no idea how to go about accomplishing the second task other than to work hard. In the 15 Invaluable Laws of Growth, I wrote about a meeting I had in 1972 with Kurt Kampmeyer, a salesman from Success Motivation Institute. Kurt introduced me to a personal growth kit that cost a whopping $799. It took Margaret and me 6 months to scrape together the money, and I bought the kit. I look back now at what that kit taught, and it was really simple. The basics of goal setting and follow through. But it was significant to me because it helped me to create a track to run on for identifying goals, breaking them down into manageable steps, and following through with the disciplines to get them done. I spent 3 years working from that growth kit, and hitting goals became a consistent part of my professional life. During that period, I read an article about the fastest-growing churches in the country, and I got excited. What if we could make our church one of them? What if we could become the fastest-growing church in the state of Ohio, I thought. That became my goal. It was a big goal, a huge goal for me. The church was already close to my lifetime goal of 500 people, and I was only in my 20s. But I was willing to strive for it. I won't bore you with all the details, but we succeeded in doubling the size of the congregation in 1 year. And in 1975, we were recognized as the fastest-growing church in Ohio. And we all celebrated. When you hit a goal like that, once the celebration is done, you start asking yourself the question, what's next? And that's what I started to do. I wondered what I should try to do next. Did I want to attempt the same thing the next year? Was there a different goal should I be going after? As I reflected and explored ideas, I came to a realization. The lessons I learned while working to grow the church were actually more important and more valuable to me than hitting any numbers or achieving the goal. In that moment, I made the shift, the personal development shift, from goals to growth. The goals I set and achieved were nice, but they weren't as significant as the growth I experienced. Goals helped me to do better, but growth helped me to become better. The growth experience was giving me a greater satisfaction than reaching individual goals. There was also another great benefit. Soon other leaders began asking me how I had accomplished the growth of the church, and I started teaching what I had learned. This was the start of my career as a leadership trainer and speaker. Achieving a goal had opened the door to opportunity, but my ongoing ability to train others and develop my career as a trainer and speaker came as the fruit of my personal growth. And I've been able to continue speaking because personal development became my focus. Growth changes. As I look back, at the time I was making this personal development leader shift from goals to growth, I can see that I made 3 significant shifts in the way that I approached becoming a better leader. Number 1, I made the shift from being growth outward to being growth inward. A little second grade student raised her hand in class to ask a teacher a question. "What did I learn today?" the boy inquired as the teacher was ending her session on basic addition and subtraction. "That's an odd question, Johnny," the teacher replied. "Why should you ask me that?" "Because that's what my parents will ask me when I get home," Johnny replied. Now, that's what I would call outward motivation. To make this shift from goals to growth, you need to find inward motivation. When I started my career, I was motivated by my desire to meet numerical goals, and every year I set those kinds of goals for myself. I'd look at every area of my career, break each large goal down into smaller, achievable goals, and then attack them. I believed that hitting numbers would automatically make me better, and I hoped that external production would increase my internal motivation. But I discovered that it did not. Instead, the focus on hitting numbers started to wear me down. That prompted me to realize that growth on the inside fuels growth on the outside, not the other way around. I recognized I needed to make a leader shift. Number two, I shifted from growth in everything to growth in a few vital things. When I understood that my focus needed to be internal rather than external, I began thinking about where and how I wanted to grow. That made me realize how unfocused I was. At age 26, my hunger to grow was greater than my willingness to get specific in my areas of growth. If you had asked me where I wanted to improve, I would have said, everywhere. But it's impossible to grow everywhere all at once. So how would I proceed? I decided to study success. My desire was to spend a year examining what made people successful and try to discover what all of them had in common. Even as I started this practice, I knew what the first quality was. Attitude. My father had taught me that. Not a naturally optimistic person, my dad had studied successful people as a youth and found out that a positive attitude was something that they all had in common. Dad had made it a regular practice to read books that promoted a positive attitude, such as the works of Norman Vincent Peale. And he paid me to read those same books as I was growing up, so that I would become intentional about continuing to improve in this area. The second characteristic I quickly attributed to successful people was the ability to develop strong relationships. This was a natural strength of mine. As a teenager, I had observed that people go along with people that they get along with. I liked people, and I found that they usually responded well to me. So I determined to leverage this natural strength and keep building on it. While I recognized that attitude and relationships were vital to success, I also recognized that they weren't enough to make a person successful. I've known plenty of relational people with good attitudes who never accomplished anything. Haven't you? I wanted to figure out what the key factor was. It took time to figure it out, but when I did, it changed my life. I read Spiritual Leadership by J. Oswald Sanders, which helped me to understand the impact of good leadership. It was then that I recognized that everything rises and falls on leadership. The last piece of the success puzzle to fall into place for me took even longer to recognize, and its discovery came through failure. In my first leadership position, I helped my organization to grow, but within 6 months of my departure, the organization had regressed. I studied that leadership failure for 6 months before I figured out the reason. I had not equipped a single person to carry on without me. Realizing this made me change the way I led, and it prompted me to start learning and developing myself as a trainer and as a coach. Since then, I focused my growth on these four key areas, which I later turned into an acronym, REAL, so that I could teach it to others. The R stands for relationships, the E stands for equipping, A for attitude, and L for leadership. Those are my focus when I read books and articles, listen to podcasts, and attend conferences. Those areas have become the focus of my teaching and my writing. Look at any speech I've given or book I've written, and you'll be able to place it into one of those four categories. If you want to grow to your potential and become a better leader, you need to grow in these four areas. You may also want to identify any other top growth needs your specific career requires and add them too. Number three, growth with a timeline versus growth without a finish line. As a young leader, I was focused on achieving goals, and one of the questions I continually asked myself as I set a goal was, how long will this take? I'm naturally impatient, and I was often preoccupied by how long any given task would take me. But as I shifted from goals to growth, my mindset also changed. My thinking shifted onto the bigger picture. And I became less impatient. Now, I won't say I became patient because everyone I know would call me out on that one. But as I made the shift, Instead of worrying about how long something might take, I started asking, how far can I go? Instead of thinking of what I was getting and how much I had to pay to get it, I started to think about what I was becoming and the impact I could make because of it. I recognized that I was on a growth journey, and I started to fall in love with personal development. What's more, at age 71, I'm still in love with it. So let me share with you the difference between having what I would call a goal-oriented culture and having a growth-oriented culture. If I'm in a goal-oriented culture, well, I value achievement. I want to reach those goals. Whereas if I'm in a growth-oriented culture, what I do is I value my development. So if I'm focused on goals, I'm basically focused on status. And if I'm focused on growth, I'm really trying to stretch. A goal-oriented culture honors privilege, where a growth-oriented culture honors serving. So if I'm goal-oriented, the emphasis is going to be on the teacher. If I'm growth-oriented, the emphasis is going to be upon the student. A goal-oriented culture basically has as the target the arrival. I've arrived. I've gotten to my goal. A growth-oriented culture, the whole purpose and the target is to growth. I am becoming better. I'm growing. In my organizations, I try to cultivate that same love, the love that I have for growth. And I do that by promoting a culture focused on growth, not goals. And here is the difference. Nowhere has my leadership from a defined timeline to an undefined finish line been more evident or more rewarding than in my writing career. I wrote my first book at age 32 because I wanted to make an impact on people that I would never meet or get to speak to. The book was called Think on These Things. I can honestly say that I gave it my best, but the end result was not very impressive. It was only about 100 pages, and that was okay. I hadn't written it to impress anyone. I had written it to make a difference. After that first book, I continued writing. I contributed a chapter to a book on time management. I did a book based on questions and answers. I worked on a Bible commentary. None of these books sold especially well, but I was happy to be learning how to write better and to reach new and larger audiences. During this early season, I was talking with Elmer Towns, a professor at Liberty University, who was one of my professors, and I found out that the lifetime sales of all his books was 110,000 copies. Now, this was back in the early 80s. He has since sold many more books, but that was a staggering figure to a small-time author like me at that time. And I found myself wondering, would it be possible for me to match that? Could I ever hope to sell 110,000 copies of my books in my lifetime? For a short time, that became my goal. But it wasn't long before I replaced that goal with the desire to grow as an author, to keep improving my writing as well as what I had to say. Years later, my assistant Linda Eggers called me to tell me that Thomas Nelson, my publisher, had sent me a gift. When I got to the office, I discovered a beautiful crystal eagle. Engraved in its base were the words, John C. Maxwell, 1 million books sold. I was amazed. Somewhere along the line, I had passed all of my sales goals, and I hadn't even been aware of it. You see, making growth my focus, it's kind of like if you have your cake and you eat it also. Growth's highest reward is not what we get from it. It's what we become by it. There was a time when people in the inner circle of Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A, were pressing him to expand the organization. We need to get bigger, they kept telling him. I've always loved Truett's response. If we get better, our customers will demand that we get bigger. That's how I feel about personal growth. When you get better, it makes you bigger. Growth is sustaining. Growth is the only guarantee that tomorrow will be better than today. How to become a growth-oriented person. Making the leadership from goal-oriented to growth-oriented isn't complicated, but it isn't easy either. It requires a shift in mindset. It takes time, but it's well worth it. If you shoot for goals, you'll achieve your goals, but you may not grow. if you shoot for growth, you'll grow and you'll achieve goals. To start making that shift, consider the 7 components of each mindset. For example, if you have a fixed mindset, you believe that intelligence is static. A growth mindset, you believe that intelligence can be developed. If you are stuck in a fixed mindset, you avoid challenges, where if you have a growth mindset, you embrace them. A fixed mindset gives up too easily, and a growth mindset persists when faced with setbacks. A fixed mindset sees effort as fruitless, where a growth mindset sees effort as a path to mastery. So, when you have a fixed mindset, you'll ignore the constructive criticism other people give you. But if you have a growth mindset, you'll welcome it. In fact, you'll learn from their constructive criticism and you'll become better. If you have a fixed mindset, you're going to feel threatened by the success of others. If you have a growth mindset, you're going to find lessons and inspirations in the success of other people. A fixed mindset plateaus early, always achieves less than full potential, where a growth mindset reaches higher levels of achievements. Number 1, embrace change. In 1974, I heard Olin Hendricks, currently the CEO of the Leadership Resource Group, say, "Growth means change." That has always stuck with me because I think it's human nature to desire improvement and resist change at the same time. And that, my friend, is impossible. If you want to become a better leader, a better employee, a better person, you must shift from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. Why? Well, a fixed mindset results in an early plateau, achieves less, and hinders people from reaching their full potential, whereas a growth mindset fuels people to a higher level of achievement. Beverly Sills said, "There are no shortcuts to any place worth going." That's certainly true when it comes to growth. It's a long, slow road, but it's a highly rewarding one, and it requires us to stretch. I wanted to illustrate this to my grandchildren one year when we were on vacation in Vail, Colorado. The first evening, I placed rubber bands of different sizes and colors around the dinner table. Our discussion that evening was about the value of being stretched beyond our comfort zones. I asked all of them to place a rubber band around their wrist as a reminder to stretch and grow during their week of snow skiing. The next evening, Ella, our youngest granddaughter, came up to me and showed me her wrist. She had 2 rubber bands on it. This morning, she said, "Papa, I looked on the ground and I saw this other rubber band." And I said to myself, it felt like this was a sign for me to be stretched twice as much. Oh, I loved her attitude. That's how we need to approach every day, because stretching is the ongoing lifestyle of a person of growth. That means continually changing when we don't feel like it, because we know it's going to lead us to the life that we really want. Number 2, adopt a teachable spirit. Growth begins with having a teachable spirit. What does this entail? It means having a passion to learn, possessing the intention to learn every day, and reflecting on what you learn so that you know how to apply it. It's a bit like gardening. A garden doesn't spring to life on its own. It requires planning, hard work, a right environment. And a gardener must do the work. Prepare the soil, plant the seed, water the plants, then feed, mulch, and weed. It's an intentional process, and it must occur every day. I try to cultivate a growth environment and maintain a teachable spirit. How do I do that? I make growth my number 1 priority. I am conscious of my need to learn 24/7, because a day without growth is not a good day for me. I look for growth possibilities in every situation. No matter what I'm doing, whether succeeding or failing, opportunities to grow are there. The question is, do I see it, and do I take advantage of it? I ask questions that help me grow. Growth doesn't find me. I must find it. The fastest way to find out what I don't know is to ask questions. And the best way to dig deeper and learn more is to ask questions. Are you getting the picture? I file what I've learned. People forget a lot of what they learn. If they want to recall it, they can't, or they can't find it. When I find articles of value, I clip them and put them in folders by subject. When I find quotes I like, I add them to index cards filed by topic. I file what I learn so that I can always regain access to it quickly. I pass what I learn on to others. Sharing something I learn reinforces growth and prompts me to make it my own. It also allows me to help others. I encourage you to find your own ways to remain teachable and facilitate learning. It will open you up to amazing new possibilities. Number 3. Make your love for learning greater than your fear of failure. Over the years, I've experienced the fruits of failure. I don't count my losses. I do count the lessons I've learned from them. I wrote, "Sometimes you win, sometimes you learn," to help people to learn from their losses. Even failure isn't failure if you learn something from it. That's how you can make failure your friend. I can remember the day that the fear of failure became my friend. It occurred in Los Angeles when I was asked to speak at a conference. Every speaker on the program was more successful, experienced, mature, and recognized than I was. I was less in every way, and I was feeling it. Finally, in the green room, I confided with one of the best speakers. "I just don't feel qualified to be speaking here," I told him. I think I was hoping for reassurance. Instead, his reply startled me. "You're not," he said. "Speak afraid. Be willing to do it afraid, and eventually you will become qualified." That was a revelation, and it created a leader shift in me. I spoke afraid, did my best, and here's what I discovered. Action reduces fear, and it increases courage. That realization was a major step toward increasing my love for learning and decreasing my fear of failure. Don't allow failure to be a bully in your life. It will if you let it. Many people get intimidated by failure every day. Instead, you need to make failure your friend. How? Fail early, fail often, and fail forward. In this season of my life, my greatest goal is to become a catalyst for the transformation of a nation. I'm spending a significant amount of time in South and Central America trying to add value to people and teach them how to raise up one another. Recently, I was asked by a reporter if I thought I would achieve that goal. My answer was, probably not. The expression on the interviewer's face indicated surprise. "Really?" "Yes. I probably won't live to see the transformation of a nation, but I would rather try something bigger than my capabilities with high odds of failure than attempt something smaller that I know that I could achieve. The fear of failure is no longer a bully in my life. I'm not afraid of failing as long as I'm stretching and growing." Number 4, develop relationships with other growing people. It's much easier to become a growing person if you're in a positive growth environment. I realized this when I was in my 20s, and it inspired me to write out a description of a growth environment. I observed that such environments have 10 characteristics. Recently, I was looking at the list, and I realized that 5 of the 10 involve other people. Here they are. 1, others are ahead of me. 2, I'm continually challenged. 3, my focus is forward. 4, the atmosphere is affirming. 5, I'm out of my comfort zone. 6, I wake up excited. 7, failure is not my enemy. 8, others are growing. 9, people desire change. And 10, growth is modeled and expected. Much of my personal growth has come as a direct result of having the opportunity to spend time with growing people. Earlier, I mentioned Elmer Towns. He is one of the growing people who was an early mentor in my formative years of my life. One of the things he taught me was what he called the hot poker principle. He used to say that if you keep the poker near the fire, it remains hot. Remove it, and over time it becomes cold. He likened growing people to fire and would often remind me, "John, stay close to the fire." That is exactly what I have tried to do. Stay close to the fire of growing people. Few things in life are better than conversation with people who are growing. Those conversations have been a great catalyst for my growth. I'm indebted to so many who have walked the growth journey with me and from whom I have learned so much. Number 5, develop greater humility. Humility is not denying your strengths, said pastor and author Rick Warren. Humility is being honest about your weaknesses. The essence of humility is being unafraid to admit when we're wrong. It's like saying, we want to be wiser tomorrow than we are today, and the more we learn and grow, the more we recognize what we don't know. Leaders who possess humility are confident, yet feel no need to draw attention to themselves. They are comfortable with themselves, yet acknowledge that they need to improve. They have self-awareness. They gratefully receive criticism, and they are not threatened when others shine. They are happy for them. Are you willing to be criticized for the sake of improvement? Are you willing to admit you're wrong in deference to your desire to change and grow? Are you willing to drop bad habits, change wrong priorities, and embrace new ways of thinking? That's what it will take to make this leadership to growth. You must be willing to admit where you're wrong so that you can discover what is right. Anyone can make that choice, but it does require humility. Number 6, believe in yourself. The law of the mirror in my book, The 15 Invaluable Laws of Growth, states, you must see value in yourself to add value to yourself. What you think about yourself determines the investment you will make in yourself. If your self-worth is low, then your investment in yourself will be low. If you see yourself as a 2 out of a 10, then you'll make a 2-level investment. If you see yourself as an 8, then you'll make an 8-level investment. That matters because your growth return will not exceed the growth of your investment. Benjamin Franklin said, empty the coins of your purse into your mind, and your mind will fill your purse with coins. What a great way to think about it. Be willing to invest in yourself. Number 7. Embrace layered learning. In 1954, politician Adlai Stevenson addressed the senior class at Princeton University. Here, in part, is what he said. What a man knows at 50 that he did not know at 20 is, for most part, incommunicable. The laws, the aphorisms, the generalities, the universal truths, the parables of the old souls, all the observations about life which can be communicated handily in ready verbal packages are as well known to a man at 20 who has been attentive as a man at 50. He has been told them all. He has read them all. He has probably repeated all of them before he graduates from college, but he has not lived them all. What he knows at 50 that he did not know at 20 boils down to something like this. The knowledge he has acquired with age is not the knowledge of formulas or forms of words, but of people, places, actions. A knowledge not gained by words, but by touch, sight, sound, victories, failures, sleeplessness, devotion, love, the human experiences and emotions of this earth and of oneself and of other men, and perhaps, too, a little faith and a little reverence for things you cannot see. At the time Stevenson made these statements, he was in his mid-50s, and what he describes is what I call layered learning. One life lesson applied upon another and another, each gaining greater insight, depth, and weight. It is wisdom acquired and applied over time, and I believe it is the best kind of learning. If you desire to grow to your maximum potential as a person and as a leader, embrace layered learning. As you do, know these things about it. Layered learning requires time and intentionality. Any gardener knows you can't force a seed to grow faster than nature intended it to. You can't make trees bear fruit before they mature. You can't rush the season. Plants need to grow, and though they may grow every day, it will not show every day. It takes a lot of growing to do a little showing. That doesn't mean we shouldn't cultivate growth every day. Small improvements over time make a big difference. Knowledge gives us a layer of learning, increasing with each added layer until it turns into wisdom. It takes years, decades, sometimes a lifetime for a person to become an overnight success. The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership has been one of my most successful books. It was the product of layered learning. I spent decades intentionally learning about leadership. I read hundreds of books. I sat down with dozens of mentors. I listened to hundreds of messages. And I daily applied what I learned. I failed and succeeded time after time. And slowly, painstakingly, I learned enough about leadership to write the book. It was a product of layered learning. Layered learning gives you a bigger picture. Layered learning is like building a picture one piece at a time. It's like receiving additional pieces of the jigsaw puzzle of leadership and putting them in place so that the picture enlarges. What you see becomes more relevant. It also enlarges you as a leader because the more pieces that you receive, the better your perspective and the greater your understanding of the principles involved in leadership. Layered learning determines the depth of a principle. Layered learning determines the length of a principle. Layered learning determines the consistency of a principle. Layered learning determines the compounding impact of a principle. You are capable of adding layers and acquiring more of the big picture than you possess today. Layered learning gives you a better picture. Recently, I received the opportunity to revise my book, Developing the Leader Within You, on the occasion of its 25th anniversary. My publisher requested that I revise at least 15% of it so that they could call it a new edition. I relished the thought of updating the book and dove in. By the time it was done, I hadn't rewritten 15%. I had rewritten 85%. It changed so much, my publisher decided to call it Developing the Leader Within You 2.0. Now, how was I able to make so many changes to a book that was already highly successful? Layered learning. In the 25 years since I had written the original version, I had continued to grow in leadership. When you make the personal development shift from goals to growth and embrace the process of layered learning, you will never stop getting better and your level of success can keep expanding. I like to think of layered learning the way that C.S. Lewis talked about learning. He said that learning isn't so much like a train going from one station to the next, so that we leave one place and move on to somewhere else. Instead, our growth is similar to that of a tree. As we learn and grow, we add new rings of understanding without giving up the older ones. We build, using the past to strengthen us, and create something new. Growth perspective. Few things have a greater positive impact than shifting from goals to growth. Why do I say that? Because the benefits are so numerous. Make growth your priority. And you will unlock and achieve your potential. You will feel good about yourself. You will strengthen your values and your abilities. You will grow in humility and self-awareness. You will become more so you can do more, and you will be an example for others to follow. I want to say one more thing about shifting from goals to growth before we move on to the next leader shift. Being a goal-oriented person means having more of a short-term mindset. We often reach for goals because we want the positive feelings that come from quick achievements. But when we make the shift to focusing on growth, it means that we begin to adopt a long-term mindset. By focusing on growth, we go from improving in spurts to improving day after day to reach our potential. That consistency compounds. And that's important. Because your level of success will never exceed your level of personal development. Now for just a personal moment with you. I've just finished reading chapter 3, and together we have learned that we need to make a shift from goals to growth. So let me tell you a story that happened to me a few years ago that just really underlined this leadership shift in my life. I had heard about a man who had gotten up to the age of 65, and he got the idea that perhaps he could live to 80, and so he counted the weeks between 65 and 80 and put the number of weeks in the form of a marble into a basket. Basically what he did was each Saturday he'd reach into the basket and he'd pull out a marble that would remind him that he had one last Saturday probably left in his life. I kind of like the idea of, you know, kind of being able to number my days, and so I thought, I think I'll do that. In fact, I went to my CEO of my companies, and I said to Mark, I said, Mark, I have this many weeks left before I want to kind of retire, and so put these into a jar and put them in the office, and every week have one of the people remove it, and that'll just remind them of how many weeks they have me left to be part of the company before I go ahead and have my own personal private life. And we started doing this. But it wasn't long till I began to understand that that was what I would call a scarcity mindset, and it certainly was a mindset of numbers. And I thought about it, and I thought, is that the way I want to live my life? By each Saturday subtracting one marble out of a jar and saying, I've got just one marble left than I had last week? That just didn't seem to be me. So I finally gathered all of my team together, and they knew the marble story, and I had it on a chair or on a desk by the chair I was sitting. I had a jar of marbles. And I pointed to it, and I said, you know what this means, and this is the countdown till when I retire. And I looked at him and said, I've been doing this wrong, and I've got to apologize to you. It's a scarcity mindset. I said, I want you to know, I'm trying to count my days and number all these days, but I got to quit this. I've got to go from counting my days, and I've got to make a shift to making my days count. Now, what was I doing? I was going from goal setting to growth setting. I no longer was into the numbers game. I was into what am I doing right now game. And then I did something that was very visual and became very dramatic. In fact, to this day, years later, they still talk about it. I took that jar of marbles, and I just turned it over, and they spilled all over the stage, and they ran off the stage, and the people kind of gasped, and then they broke into applause, and then they stood to their feet, and all of them got the idea that I finally got. I was a little slow, but I finally got it. Quit living in the goal life of just trying to number your days and just started living in the growth light. Make every day count. Forget the marbles. Make today count. The only time we have is now. So, let's use it wisely. I'm ready to go to the next chapter, and I think you're willing and ready to go with me. Chapter 4, Perks to Price, The Cost Shift. Napoleon Hill said, strength and growth come through continuous effort and struggle. He was certainly right. I've met a lot of people who desire to become leaders. That's only natural since I do so much teaching and writing on this subject. When I get the chance to interact with people one-on-one, I often ask them why they want to be leaders. Sometimes their answers reveal that their motivation is really about the perks of leading. They want to be in control. They want others to do what they say. They want a nicer office. They want a higher income. They want a better parking place. When I started out as a young leader, my thoughts were similar. I was enamored with my title of pastor. It conveyed to me that I was the shepherd of the flock, and I thought people would automatically follow me because they needed me. They would rely on me for direction and be grateful for everything I did for them. It seemed so simple. Then reality hit. The people of the church were kind to me, but they didn't automatically follow me. That's when I learned that what I later called the law of E.F. Hutton, that when the real leader speaks, people listen. The title that I expected to be so important didn't come with any of the perks that I had anticipated. I learned that I would have to earn influence myself along the way.